Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, the last show of 2019, so Happy New Year to all of you. It's a real treat for me to start a lengthy interview with my colleagues, and two of them former colleagues.
It's Mark Jacob, formerly of the Tribune and Sun-Times, Rich Cahan, formerly of the Sun-Times, and City 2000, which I felt like a real part of, the official biographer of City 2000. And Michael Williams. Together, they have come out with a new book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. Haunting being, to my mind, after just reading it over the weekend, the operative image. How did this book come to be?
Well, it goes back, I think, there's a different story for each of us, really. I think for me, it was, I've always been fascinated by World War II. And then my father-in-law was a navigator, and he never talked about the war.
Same with my dad.
And he obviously had seen really difficult and disturbing things, and he wouldn't talk about it. And I think it frustrated our family, it frustrated me, and I think a lot of people have this same story.
No question.
So I wanted to put together a book that was unflinching, a book that was the opposite of what we saw on 1950s and 60s television and movies, a book that would fill in some of the gaps, and a book that would be unabashed in its telling the truth and laying out this history. And then Rich and I discovered this collection, the Signal Corps collection at the National Archives.
When you say discover it, Rich, how did you two discover this? I mean, you literally go to the National Archives and say, hey, let's see what they got.
I'm embarrassed to say that's pretty much what we do.
Well, that's a good way to do things. What are you kidding? That's
one of the best ways to research is to go to a library or an institution and say, what should we write a book about?
Yeah.
And everyone has a kind of a secret project. And this collection was spectacular. There were about 200,000 photographs that were taken in 1945, and that seemed to be like a real pivotal year.
During the course of the year. The book is arranged,
right,
and I think it's a shrewd way to arrange it chronologically in that one year.
Well, I mean, it's such a huge subject that if you tried to do the whole war, you would never finish. And, we all decided to focus on it, on the year 1945, which seemed like a year when, the worst calamity in the Earth's history happened, and when a new world kind of dawned.
And the knowledge of a catastrophe that had been going on for 4 years in concentration camps with the attempt to obliterate part of the human race. Were these Mark Jacob, when did you first see these images?
Well, I came to it after Michael and Richard because, I mean, they went to the National Archives and went through all these pictures and just picked a bunch of them. And there was about this time I was leaving the Tribune and going into freelance writing. And they said, hey, are you really interested in this project? And I love World War II history, and I've been studying it for a number of years.
You love history in general.
Yeah. And so I said, I jumped at the opportunity to be involved in the project. And so the three of us just went through it and kind of went through the pictures and decided which ones to use, which ones not to. And my one of my jobs was to kind of chase down the details of what the photos showed and to write, a lot of the...
Yeah, I think I must tell you also the captions in here, it's mostly two photographs a page, one relatively large, one relatively small. And the captions are so informative, sometimes chillingly. So what did you three learn about, and you must have been beyond intrigued by the dozens, I think, of photographers. Mm-hmm. Who were these men? Exclusively men?
They were certainly all men. And actually, we started by writing the captions for each of the pictures, so we really focused on World War II, and then we got to that exact question: who were these men who took these incredible
What information
pictures?
Was available in the archive? You would see a picture, and some of them...
Just their name. And so we went back to the archives, and instead of looking at the photo files, we looked at the battalion and the unit files, and there were some great records. They would write reports every morning. They're called morning reports about what they did.
Wow.
They had company newsletters. They had company newspapers. So we learned a tremendous about each of the men. And then we found that a half dozen of them wrote memoirs. Many of them kind of self-published, and many of them held by their family.
And well, so, one of the nice things about the book, too, is you pull a number of large quotes, such as this from a fellow named Bill Tease of the 166th Signal Photographic Company. There were elements I couldn't walk away from because all the elements for great photography were there. And to just walk away from it just to save my neck would have been stupid. That's in its way an inspiring quote.
You know, Rick, the book is really two separate books in a way, because it tells the story of 1945, this incredible year in world history. But it also tells the story of these soldier photographers, these men who, many of whom had never been professional photographers at all. Most of them had not. So they'd worked at a camera store, you know, selling cameras, for example, or not even that much involvement with cameras. And they, you know, went through all the training in both still and movie photography, and then were sent out. And when you think about it, those photographers were in the front lines and saw more action than the soldiers.
Oh, no question. You certainly get
there
that sense.
There were no photographs a mile behind the front lines.
Yeah. In a way, some of these, it's almost as if someone had been able to go to hell. Mm-hmm. Some of these are photographed from a sort of hell on earth.
Absolutely.
Don't you think, Michael?
Yeah, and I think when you start looking at the book, you'll notice this unique perspective, and it's that these guys, they were kind of following in the wake of the fighting.
Yeah.
So they were recording the results of war. They were recording the impact of war. And that's really what the book is about. It's not a book of war pictures.
No.
It's really a book of the toll of war. It's the impact on refugees, the victims of this kind of violence. And I think as you go through the book, you'll see that there's this tremendous story that wasn't told, and that's kind of the victim story. It seems like in most war books, it's about the victors, it's about the generals, it's about the people who kind of conceived of the war and the people who fought the war. This book is about the aftermath of the war, and I think that that's kind of the perspective we wanted to take, because this collection has been used a lot. At the National Archives, they say this is the most used collection, and it's...
Is that right? What has it been used for?
Well, it's interesting. It's what Mike means is that the World War II collection
sure,
has been used
sure.
a lot. And most history books really end pretty much by 1945. Yes, there's pictures of concentration camps, but pretty much most of the pictures in the books are the action pictures, the D-Day pictures.
Well, there's not a picture of three prostitutes in a Japanese brothel.
So that's why the collection has been used, but this part of the collection, I think, is pretty... Yeah.
And
this
were you able to use whatever you wanted?
It's all the people's property. I mean, it's all the government and the American people own it.
Yeah. Mark, were some of these, I know you know history and you know World War II, and not an expert, but you know World War II. Talk to me about going through these images. What emotions? You two guys must have been a little, or Rich and Mike, a little overwhelmed, but what was it like for you?
For me, you know, because I'd read all about the movement of armies, you know, and I got all that, and I knew, you know, where the key things that had happened, but I didn't really recognize civilians and how the toll, you know, three times as many civilians died as soldiers, as combatants.
Yeah.
And the pictures that we end up using, a lot of them show the effect of war on just regular people. And,
exactly.
And you know, people, refugees, but also we have, there's really amazing pictures of German villagers after the Allies came through, and the Allies making the German villagers face up to the atrocities that had been happening, you know, hundreds of yards away from their homes.
We got to take a short little break, but these gentlemen will be on till 10:15 talking about Aftershock, the human toll of war, haunting World War II images by America's soldier photographers. One of the many offerings from City Files Press. CityFilesPress.com. We'll be right back.
There's a wondrous place in Lake Barrington where everything Christmas is now at a discounted price. It's the Tree Time After Christmas Clearance Sale. With such huge savings, you won't have to think twice. Many artificial trees and ornaments and lots of decorations. And discounts so big, it will be hard to resist the temptations. We're open 7 days a week and items are going fast. Since all quantities are limited, they're sure not to last. Stock up for next Christmas now, as the opportunity opportunity won't be here long. You'll be saving so much green, you simply can't go wrong. Visit our Christmas clearance sale showroom on Pepper Road off Route 14 in Lake Beddington, and you'll see we're still everything Christmas for your discounted holiday decorations and tree.
Treetime.com. Everything Christmas, treetime.com.
Details and showroom and website.
Have you ever thought about saying goodbye to your job? Just walking into your boss and saying, I quit. And how would you like to commute to work without ever leaving your home? Well, not long ago, a 39-year-old entrepreneur from a billionaire family spent $20 million in 3 years to find the best home-based business in North America. He researched 70 different companies, and when he found the only one that had real long-term potential, he bought it. And right now, he's looking for people to help him turn this company into his next billion-dollar success story. So if you're serious about making money from home without having to leave your home, well, grab a pen. Because I'm about to give you the address of a website where you can learn all about this unique and rare opportunity. Write this down. www.gohernext.com. Now get on your computer and go to this site now. Part-time or full-time, your income is based totally on your performance. Interested? GoHereNext.com and say goodbye to your boss tomorrow. GoHereNext.com.
Cards for Kids. KARS Cards for Kids. 1-877 Cards for Kids. Donate your card today.
1-877 Cars for Kids. KARS Cars for Kids. 1-877 Cars for Kids. Donate your car today.
Hurry! It's your last chance to donate for 2019. Donate now at carsforkids.org. That's Cars with a K. Pickup is quick and easy. You'll also get a vacation voucher and a tax deduction.
1-877 Cars for Kids. KARS Cars for Kids. 1-877 Cars for Kids. Donate your car today.
Hurry! It's your last chance to donate for 2019.
Yeah, that's a charming voice on a commercial. We're back. Me, Rick Kogan, Mark Jacob, Rich Cahan, and Michael Williams, who have collaborated on the latest, one of the latest offerings from their City Files Press, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II. Images by America's soldier photographers. We're talking about the nature of some of the pictures. I want to mention first, the cover picture is about as haunting a photograph as I've ever seen. The man looks
It's a guy named
ghostly.
It's a PFC named Jack Pulliam from Pennsylvania, and he was captured during the Battle of the Bulge on his 21st birthday, and he spent the next month in German captivity. He was taken back to Germany to be a slave laborer, and he managed to escape, and he was hiding in a house when a German officer came in order to avoid being recaptured. He killed the German officer, and the picture on the cover shows a young man, Jack Pulliam, with these thousand-yard stare eyes and just the most exhausted face like you could imagine. And he's wearing a cap, and that's the cap of the German officer who he killed.
One of the other things about this photograph is it looks like it was, you know, so professionally lit in a studio of some kind. Right. It is just as
my guess is he's kind of approaching a Jeep or some lights from the
Or if, is there flash? Were they using flash?
I don't think.
I would doubt it. Because you're in a war zone.
You don't want to use a flash.
You don't want those bulbs.
But I think he was just approaching the American lines, and it's probably a Jeep.
Was there any argument among the three of you about that being the cover picture? No. And there must have been some debate.
But you know what?
We didn't know much about his life story, and we tracked down his son. And his son told his son said, "Well, my father kept a 19-page memoir about what happened to him." And that's, you know, we kind of always, in most of our books, we let the pictures lead us.
Absolutely.
And wherever the picture takes us is where we go. And so every picture there's been a tremendous amount of research. Mark contacted people all over the world to find out.
How many photos are in this book? Roughly.
Oh, about 200.
About 200.
Seems like more.
And so, you know, we picked photos for their both their art value and all for their meaning and for their humanity, and then
and just, their storytelling and
then,
value.
Then investigated what they meant.
It is a rough book. You were mentioning that before the show started.
There are some images. I'm just saying that there are some images that are grisly.
But I think there's a tremendous amount of humanity.
No question.
As some of it is.
Yeah. No.
But you know what? We wanted it to be rough in some ways.
You wanted it to be real.
Yeah, there were moments where we thought about a couple of pictures and whether we should show them, and we thought there'll never be another chance for these pictures to be
good
shown.
Good for you. Good
it's
for
important
the three.
That people
and,
see it.
And also, you know, think about it. Right now, America is in the longest war in American history, yet it makes almost no impact on almost all Americans. Huh. And so, why is that? Our sense of what war is and what the potential for it to be to take over all of our lives. Has almost been lost.
And well, it's been lost. I mean, back since Vietnam, when it was the living room war, and we were seeing most of us as youngsters seeing these images come through. Then not hearing from our parents. My father never told me what it was like to be on Guadalcanal and be in a hospital after the war for 6 months. He never shared that. My father was a sort of sharing kind of guy. And then everything has become kind of secreted. Mm-hmm. And unless you know someone who is in service, in combat, you really don't know war. Now, it's an abstract, don't you think? Mm-hmm. And this book really brings it home. Those many, many, many World War II fans are a potential audience for this thing. People like us who have relatives who fought in the war and we never heard anything about it are. But also, don't you think, I think everybody, this gives an understanding much deeper than Saving Private Ryan or as good as this 1917 movie may be. It gives an understanding of much more depth.
Yeah.
Humanity, as you guys have said.
I hate to admit it, but everyone is always asking us before we write a book, who's your target audience?
And well, those people are idiots who are asking.
My answer is...
How dare they ask a publishing house who their audience is?
But truly, our target audience is everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anyone that can look at this book, whether they buy it or they find it in a library, and not be affected by it.
Yeah.
For years, for the rest of their lives even. That we certainly were.
Mm-hmm. When you decide to, how do you promote a book like this? Besides something like this, it's hard to have a kind of book party for this, unless we're explaining it, I think, in a way that makes it not just palatable to people, right. but accessible to people. How do you go about marketing a book like this, fellas? Publishers.
Yeah, marketing is a challenge on all of our books, but I think what we try to do is create products that are so irresistible and so worthwhile that people actually want to read it. We have something of a cult market, people who wait for City Files books, and they know that there's a
quality
to it, and they know that there's a certain seriousness and point to it and purpose of it, and that's how we start, and we go from there, I hope.
Tell me about the photos. The photos in this book, you were talking about it off air, I think, Mark, and complimenting Michael tremendously about the way these, not just the layout of the book, but the pictures themselves.
There are a lot of, I think, Michael, who did virtually the entire design of the book, and he has such great taste and also has such passion for the work. And for example, in this book, all the photos are shown full frame, including the borders, including
I'm looking at the photo right now where you can read
what kind of film it was and you can read the numbers. That I believe that, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but part of what you were trying to get at was that this was evidence.
Yeah, definitely. When you go to the National Archives, you're presented with these hundreds and hundreds of books of contact prints. And you can see that a lot of these were cropped. So, number one, we felt...
Parts of it chopped off.
Yeah. We felt that these need to be presented full frame as they were, as pieces of evidence. We're not trying to hide anything. The other thing was at the National Archives is this is a collection that had been used really often. So they were kind of dog-eared and frayed.
Sure.
And I really didn't want to go and kind of reproduce those pictures that had been used that way. But this opportunity came up to scan from the negatives from the first time.
Wow.
These are the actual photographer's negatives that were from Hiroshima, from Nagasaki, from the camps. And they are able to be reproduced with incredible clarity and depth.
When the there's something palpable about them in that they hit you in the same way, not as if you were taking the shot itself, but that's the shot that was taken. We got to take a little commercial break and come back. We're talking to these fine gentlemen, Mark Jacob, Rich Cahan, and Michael Williams of, not all of you, but Mark is related enough to cityfilespress.com to be considered a part of that whole thing. We'll talk about their other offerings, too. We'll be right back.
Chicago's very own WGN Radio Chicago.
America's oil and gas moves through 2.4 million miles of underground pipelines safely. But one of those pipelines were gone. We would need 90,000 more tanker trucks or 27,000 more rail cars every single day just to meet our energy needs. So, do you want this, this, or this? We move America's energy. We are Energy Transfer.
Attention investors, sick of market ups and downs, not earning cash flow of 18 to 21% targeted consistently? Want a plan around future recessions? National Realty's Class A Buildings Fund is made up of prime income producing real estate. You're secured on large apartment buildings. You're backed by $750 million of high quality new construction. You receive monthly electronic cash flow payments. You're diversified with 15 large buildings supporting your money. Your investment is managed and perfect for retirement. These prime building locations back you with hard money-making assets. Remember, no matter what type of market, it's always a landlord's market. Call now for your free guide to secured realty investment wealth. Just call now and learn our proven insider method. Our 13-year flawless track record and 900 repeat investors proves it. Call 201-210-2727. That's 201-210-2727.
An offer to buy or sell any security is only made by our private placement memorandum. Read it first and invest wisely. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. National is a real estate development firm. See us at NRIA.net.
In the Army National Guard, family means everything.
Our parents, they were really supportive that all five of us would join. I got my education because of the Guard. I got to travel a little bit and experience a whole different culture. It helped me get my job, helped me pay for my house.
Serving part-time in the Army National Guard instills pride that you and your family will share. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Illinois Army National Guard. Aired by the Illinois Broadcasters Association and this station.
DriveChicago.com.
Your only source for pre-owned vehicles in Chicagoland.
Buy from a dealer you can trust.
Thousands of high-quality manufacturer-certified vehicles.
Many coming off lease right now.
Log on.
DriveChicago.com.
Welcome back. These fine gentlemen will be on until about 10:15. I want to read another quote from one of the photographers featured in their remarkable book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. One of those men was a man named Charles E. Sumners of the 166th Signal Photographic Company. He said this, "Sometimes people ask, why does God allow war? I don't know the answer to this. But war is a terrible thing, sometimes a necessary thing, that dramatically affects everybody involved. Sometimes war has meaning, and sometimes it has none. However, there's one constant. Those who suffer the most have nothing to gain from its outcome and had nothing to do with starting it." That is an unbelievable quote. Mark, you were mentioning a photo, one of the photos that is one of your favorites, that is not a photo of destruction.
Right. If you look in the page through the book, you'll see like rubble in cities and refugees and distraught people and even dead bodies. But
sure.
But a picture that one of my favorite pictures just shows there's a line of about five men sitting in chairs, and there's another man riding a bicycle in front of them, and he's lost a limb, and all of them have lost a limb. And he's demonstrating for them how to ride a bicycle with one leg. And to me, it's almost a funny picture, Rick.
It's a kind of encouraging, to me, it's kind of an empowering picture. Right. You're right.
And an optimistic one.
No question.
But you think about why that was necessary. You have to teach people how to live the rest of their life with missing limbs because you've had a war. And so it's a really telling picture, I think.
Michael Williams, after having done this book, do you understand with any more depth why your father didn't talk about his experiences in the war?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you learn anything in this project?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder didn't exist back then.
Nope.
I think that a lot of these men thought that they were doing us a favor by not sharing these experiences with us. And I think now we've learned over the years that this is probably not a good way to approach these kinds of horrific things. There's a beautiful introduction to our book by Carol Guzzi, who was a war photographer and won 4 Pulitzers. And she talks about the way this has affected her life profoundly, dramatically. And I think it really gives you insight, particularly since there's really no photographers left to talk about it today.
Yeah.
She lets us know how it feels to do this, the toll it is on the photographer. And I think that's why we selected a lot of these pictures, is that these guys lived and died for some of these pictures. They put their lives at risk. We're not going to edit these out. We're not going to censor these pictures. These were gifts that they gave to us to learn from those experiences. So we did not want to censor them. We wanted to share them.
Showcase them, yeah.
Absolutely.
And they were aware of that. They wrote sometimes that one day historians are going to come around, they're going to see these pictures. They understood how important this was. And they went off to war without guns. You know, they were carrying a camera instead of guns. And that's just amazing on the front line.
Let me ask you, though, when they came back from the war with cameras, presumably, did any of them go on to careers as photographers? Did you learn any?
A surprising few. At the end of the book, there's profiles of 60
of
the photographers. Love,
yeah.
And Yale Joel became a life photographer. There was, it's funny that Russ Meyer, the famous movie maker, was a filmmaker with these still photographers.
Collaborator of Roger Ebert. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Famously.
In fact, you mentioned photographer William Tease. There's a movie called The Incredible Bill Tease. That was his buddy who was a still photographer. But I think most of them put down the camera seriously because they had seen it all. What was there to take? You know, whether they're going to become a photographer for the local newspaper and take the Shriners.
Bar mitzvahs and weddings,
Exactly. Yeah. So they went on to oftentimes careers that were associated with photography. They became engravers. They became journalists. They became reporters, things like that.
You know, and the very fact that they were not professional photographers
right.
to start with, if they had been, they would have already have seen a dead body. They would have already seen horrific things happening. But the fact that they went into war not having seen those before... Right. meant that they took different kinds of pictures. And I've always thought that the quality of these pictures was different than journalistic photographs.
No question. I think that's one of the engaging aspects of the photos. They're not posing anything. They're not thinking to themselves, oh, this would be a good picture to put on page 3 with Joe Schmo's column or anything. There's none. They're not carrying that responsibility.
Right.
So there's a real freedom.
They're literally putting the film onto little airplanes, and those airplanes are going back to London or Paris and then sent back to the United States. So that responsibility is gone. All they have to do is take the picture and write a caption. And they did write really fine, clear captions.
Well, because I'm sure, you know, unlike some of the photographers that we've all worked with, who, like Charles Osgood, you're listening, who don't, you know, it'll be filled in by someone else. And these guys knew that it was not going to be filled in by someone else, and it was up to them to get it right.
Right.
Right. Well, it is just a remarkable book. Again, it's called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. Rich Kahan and Michael Williams of City Files Press put it together, and Mark Jacob came on to write these astonishingly informative and enlightening captions and make the book more than a photo album, to make it a real... In reading it, and I think reading and looking at the same, as you know, these old-fashioned as I may be, it really took me there.
Tell us your experience of reading it. Did you start?
I will. Yes. We have to take a commercial break.
Okay.
But I did. You know what? What occurred to me about it is, okay, we live in a really frenetic communication age, and it was such a joy for me to sit with this book and look at a picture and read about the picture and/or the photographer, and then look at the picture again. Right. It put me in a very contemplative mood, and in this day and age, I don't get the opportunity for that. We do have to take another commercial break, but we'll talk to these guys after whatever we hear at the top of the hour, the short news, and we'll move off this book and talk a little more about what City Files Press does. I remember City Files was just a store.
It was.
And then it became a press, and now it's thriving. So we'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Mark Jacob, Rich Cahan, and Michael Williams. We've been talking a lot about their riveting book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers with Words by Mark Jacob. Their other recent collaborative effort is Chicago Rules, Federal Cases That Defined the City and the Nation. They are the authors. There's a foreword by Rebecca Pallmeyer and an introduction by the one and only Scott Turow. City Files is still going strong.
We are, despite the odds.
Yeah.
It's not a great time to be a book publisher.
But, no, it's not. It certainly wasn't 20-some years ago either, I'll
tell
you.
But in other ways, there's really interesting issues in the world, and publishing is more possible in some ways by kind of all these international connections. So we're hanging in there.
Let me ask all of you, I hinted at this in describing my feelings about Aftershock, but tell me your feelings about print, ink on paper, and static images, still images, on a page in this, you know, Twitter, Instagram, BS kind of age in which we live. I think there's an increasing value in just being able to stop for a second.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Whenever we do a book, you live with this book for a year, two years, 3 years. We've been living with these pictures for 3 years. But when I got that first copy and held it in my hand and sat in my lap, it was like looking at all of these pictures for the first time. Because there's a big difference between looking at a picture on a tiny screen, kind of pixelated and blown out, and then seeing something reproduced and lingering with it and reading about it and just really absorbing all of that. For me, the experience of reading a book is much different than just looking, you know, Google imaging something and seeing some pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So we're big believers in it. I mean, this is what our careers are about, and we believe in it very strongly.
And I think we have a special niche. People are starting to notice, even all over America, that there's not many people who do books based on, they're not really photo books, but they're books based on photography, and we let the pictures lead us to lots. We sneak in a lot of words in our books. People,
no
don't
question. I think that's the joy of them too.
There's a lot of people who are doing photo books, and it's just pictures.
Oh yeah, just pictures.
But this is a real, you know, we really believe in this kind of mystic and important combination of words and pictures. When they're together, they're very powerful.
Mark,
well, it's funny because I'll have to confess, I consume the news totally online now. I do not really read ink on paper anymore for the news, although most of my friends do. But I think a book like the books we're producing here are not, they're not fleeting news items. They're meant to be held with two hands, and to be paged through. I delight in watching people look at our books and just sit there and page through and look and see how long they linger on certain pages. They used to be, when I was working at the newspapers at the Sun-Times and at the Tribune, I used to like to go on the L and watch people read the print paper and see what they stopped at, what they read, what they, you know, and what they consumed, because back then you couldn't tell how many page views you had or how many, you know, what the engagement time was, whether someone was reading it for 35 seconds or a minute and 35 seconds, but which you can now.
Yeah, I know you
can. But so that was my little focus group was writing the L. But so I do that with these books now, and it's kind of a satisfying experience to watch people appreciate the books.
You know, we lived in an age where print dominated over pictures and newspapers, and the print people were on top of the picture people. But I think now we all realize how important pictures are. Try putting a Facebook item in without a picture and see how far you get.
Yeah, good point. I don't use Facebook much, but you know,
or anything. You know.
What are you going to do? It's an ongoing pleasure to watch you guys work. What can I say, Michael Williams? Mark Jacob, Rich Cahan, latest book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. It is about 1945, and it is real, and it is potent, and it is powerful, and because of you guys being so passionate, it works.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Great to see you guys. We're all friends, too, so that's the bonus. We'll take a little break, then we're going to talk about a baseball movie and about how the United States government screwed one of the great Teamster leaders of all time.
Okay, here comes one amazing real estate tip. Listen to this. I'm John Williams, and joining me is Ron Wexler with Keller Williams Preferred Realty. Thanks for joining us today, Ron.
Thanks, John.
You guys have something where you are doing, I think, kind of unique in the real estate market. What is that?
Yeah, so it's called the Instant Offer Program. We give people an offer that they can immediately take without ever putting the home on the market, without ever fixing it up, without ever showing it.
So that means you're coming with cash. You are the buyer. You're going to take this property.
Correct. It's us or an investor we're working with, and it's an instant offer.
Do you want me to paint, rearrange furniture, stage it?
Nothing. Obviously, the goal is to get absolute top dollar. If we did put it on the market, if you paid a full commission, if you did everything, here's the most you're going to get out of your house. Then we say, here's what we'd be willing to pay for the house with an instant offer without any of the normal fun of selling your home.
I don't know anybody doing what you are doing. Here's the number to call, right? 708-629-5151.
Call or text 708-629-5151.
Or just remember, thewexlergroup.com.
Happy holidays. This is David Hochberg, host of WGN's newest Saturday morning show, Home Sweet Home Chicago. Our first show will be Saturday, January 4th from 10 a.m. until noon, following House Smarts with Lou Manfredini. In addition to MegaPros Joe of MegaPros Home Improvement, we will also have local respected industry leaders co-hosting the show every weekend, answering all of your home improvement questions. Home Sweet Home Chicago Radio Show, Saturdays, 10 until noon, following House Smarts with Lou Manfredini, beginning January 4th.
Get ready to go Gatsby and roar into the new year. During the Roaring 2020s New Year's Eve party at Majestic Star, we're putting on the Ritz with free valet, free entertainment, free party favors, and a free champagne toast at midnight. Plus, win a share of the $20,200 Bootleggers Bounty. It's all happening this New Year's Eve at Majestic Star Casino. Because a little party never hurt nobody. Visit MajesticStarCasino.com for details. Must be 21. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-9 with it.
Welcome back. We're going to spend the second 45 minutes here talking to two incredibly talented filmmakers. One, Phil Donnelly, is also an actor. I want to start with, have you guys been talking?
A little bit in the green room, we have, yeah.
And you saw a clip of George Bogdanich's documentary, Betrayal.
I saw a trailer for it, and it looks utterly fantastic.
George, it's a haunting, I think, Kafka-esque story. How did you come to it?
A friend of mine introduced me to a Chicago labor leader, Teamster, Bill Hogan.
Yeah, legendary Teamster.
He's a guy that helped bring the film industry, the commercial film industry, into the city, went out to the West Coast and on a number of trips, and then helped broker agreements that made it easy for both the union people and the
Hollywood folks too,
to come together. He did the same thing for the trade shows as well, his local 714. They worked out the problems that had existed at McCormick Place. And yet, despite all this, he found himself barred for life.
So sad. it's a tragedy, Phil. And, Phil, who has made movies around here, I mean, the first... The Blues Brothers started the whole thing, didn't it, George?
It was one of the very first of the productions that came here. There were a lot of union people involved on that one, and Jim Belushi became very close to Bill Hogan. They made four films together.
So did one of the people in the movie, too, among the many interviews. There must be 30 interviews in this movie. Christy Hefner is also interviewed on camera. How did she become close to Billy?
She is a civil liberties advocate.
Like her dad.
And the First Amendment, what we found out is that under the Justice Department draconian rule that when they took over the Teamsters Union, free speech was really trampled on. And people that merely spoke to anyone who had been barred could themselves be barred for life.
Well, which Hogan was, yes, with, I think, tragic circumstances. I'm not saying his wife of, I think, 48 or 58 years, yeah, Ginny, has suffered a stroke. Yeah. This is, when you come to a film like this, George, why do you choose the documentary style? And I'm thinking of a movie, this big hit movie, you know, where, you know, goofy, overplaying Al Pacino in The Irishman is Jimmy Hoffa. Oh. The Jimmy Hoffa in your movie is infinitely more dramatic and interesting than Al Pacino's overplayed part.
That's what he does for two, 3.5. How long was the movie? 7 hours?
3.5.
He's screaming the whole time.
Yeah. He was an interesting guy, to say the least. I mean, he is on the one hand extremely talented union man who managed to put together the master freight agreement. It was just as good a labor leader as you could find. At the same time, he made deals with the devil. And when he ended up going to jail, the union ended up in the hands of people who were actually controlled by the mob.
Well, but one of the most evil characters in your film, and it's going to be playing this Saturday, this coming Saturday at the Siskel Center. It's also got another end January 9th, yes, right? The biggest devil in this film is Jimmy Hoffa Jr., to my mind. There are a lot of bad people in this movie.
Rudy Giuliani being,
yeah, you're right. Rudy Giuliani is the worst person who's ever lived. But Jimmy Hoffa Jr. too is a bad guy.
Yeah, unfortunately, he turned his back on everybody that helped him, and he started with a promise that he was going to help end the government control of the union, and then he found the government watchdog useful to target his potential rivals.
Well, he was jealous of people like Hogan, right?
He absolutely was.
When you make, how long did it take you to make this film, George?
About 3 years.
3 years?
Yeah.
Have you ever made a dramatic film, a theatrical film?
Not
this
yet.
Is pretty theatrical. You know, you two guys, what's interesting to both of you is you have to have, Phil, you have made your own film here. Ghost in the Tower? What is it called?
Gee, thanks, Rick. You really did your research.
Well, I thought
Ghost
you'd
in
fill
the
in
tower.
I thought you'd fill in the blanks. Promote your film.
The Man in the Silo. Well, it's
Man in the
Silo.
Ghost
been out.
In, should have been Ghost in the
yeah,
Silo.
Sure.
How long did it take you to make that?
Gosh, I mean, it took a while because, like, once it hit post-production, but the writing and the filming of it was like a year.
See, what I'm trying to get at, it is not easy. You may think, you know, with all these, you know, Star Wars this and, you know, DC Comics mm-hmm. this, that it's a really easy thing to make a movie. You have to devote a lot of energy, and there's a ton of frustration either from the commercial side and from the documentary side. Would you agree, Phil?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're doing anything independently, it's always going to take longer. If you have a studio sort of, you know, something that's got a lot of money behind it, it's a fully planned out, before you even go into pre-production, they have the end date, the delivery date when it's going into theaters. And so you've got all these benchmarks you have to hit, and you've got the money to be able to hit them because you've got people on payroll contracts. They're waiting to, like...
So the film you star in mm-hmm. brilliantly, High and Outside, baseball noir, how did that happen? I mean, was that certainly an independent film, mm-hmm. yes?
Yeah, so I was doing this play in Hollywood, a Sam Shepard play called Fool for Love with Jeffrey Lewis, the late, great Jeffrey Lewis. High and Outside was his last movie. He died literally almost after he wrapped. Mm. We were still had to shoot more of the movie, but he was shot out. And then he literally died doing what he loved. Anyway, I did a play with him. Director came and saw the play. And it was at one of the after parties for the play. Jeff's wife mentioned you two should play father and son. The director was standing nearby. He heard this, sort of
log that info in his mind. And a couple of years later, he said, I've got this movie for you and Jeff to play. So it didn't happen in the traditional sense. I was very lucky, extremely lucky. I mean, this is not typically, people don't write movies for you unless you're like really very famous.
Unless you can get a movie made. It's interesting that you're film On and Outside premiered at the Siskel, where George's film. George, did your film premiere? It was here before, was it not?
We had a premiere of a shorter version at the Davis Theater.
Okay.
And that was like 56 minutes. Now it's 70. Important material. It's 70 minutes.
How hard is it? How hard was it to get both of your movies? To get, I mean, when you make a film, whether as an actor, as a director, man in the silo, as a director, as a producer, as anything, you want people to see it. How difficult is it, you first, Phil, to get people to see it? Man in the Silo particularly, because that was your film. It was how long, how many minutes?
It was like an hour long. I really made it only as a director's calling card to get myself more work. And then it sort of turned out to be something bigger. It went to festivals and made a name for itself. I didn't plan on that, but we were just talking about this in the green room, actually. It is very difficult. I mean, it takes a lot of money and a lot of resources to get people to know about your film. Thank God there's the Siskel Film Center and places like it, where they're willing to take a chance on independent, lesser known projects. Because otherwise, really, you're dealing with theaters, and a lot of these studios, they're four walling those theaters.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of money to do that.
You know, it's a case of you raise some money, you shoot some footage, you go back and raise some money, shoot some more footage. Until you get to the point, you know.
How did you become a filmmaker? I know you as a writer. You're a talented writer. How did you make that leap into?
Well, I really got involved with the war in the former Yugoslavia back in the late 90s or early, 2000. I saw that what was on the evening news was in many ways misleading if you knew about it.
Yeah.
And what we did is we went back to people that were very knowledgeable on the inside, and after the war was over, all of a sudden they're free to speak about what really went down. And, there was kind of a herd mentality in the press. When the war was going on, obviously,
as there often is,
the Second Front. Yeah. John MacArthur had a really good book about how you have the one front is the physical battle. Maybe the more important one is the propaganda battle between the two sides.
Mm.
And so we tried to pierce that as much as we could, and I found that film was a more effective media for deconstructing what actually happened.
Phil, you also write, which I find, and I guess the ideal world for you would be to write a script in which you can star and which you can direct.
Yes, would that would not be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be nice for everybody. Yeah. How do you find
how much money do you have, Rick?
Nothing.
And can you write a check tonight?
I can't write a check for anything.
All right.
How much would you
can
like?
Can you pay my bill at the Billy Goat, by the way?
That I can do.
Thank you.
That I can always do. That I can always do. What do you find more in doing them both, in doing all these aspects of filmmaking, what do you find the most challenging and or difficult?
I think the hardest thing, hands down, is writing. Writing is the hardest thing to do. Directing is the next hardest thing, and then acting. It's why I think there's lots of actors, less directors, and even fewer writers. And I'm not taking away, I mean, I love acting and that's how I started, but, writing's it's very disciplined. Directing is also, you can't, actors on set, they can do things like they can drink or they can show up late. I mean, they can go out all night and not sleep. You can't do that when you're directing because you're writing the ship every single day you're showing up on set. And if you lose your temper, everybody on the set all of a sudden loses their temper. But writing is such a an isolated thing, and you've got to be really disciplined.
You have to be disciplined,
and
yeah.
It's hard. And you know, one of my writing partners, the great Joe Sikora,
of Power and yes. many other things.
And we have an actual schedule that we adhere to, and we have a process that we do. So we like everything is it's very methodical,
God, that's
and we have
great.
All of these dates and timelines that we hit. So everyone's got their own way, but I think writing is hands down the hardest thing to do.
We will explore with these two fine fellows, George Bogdanich and Phil Donlan, the intricacies of filmmaking and what it means to be a filmmaker from Chicago. I think that is a crucial element after this short break. Welcome back. We're spending the rest of this show talking to filmmaker George Bogdanich, whose documentary, Betrayal, When the Government Took Over the Teamsters Union, will be showing at the Siskel Center this Saturday and January 9th. Phil Donlan, who's high and outside of baseball noir, showed at the Siskel Center last year sometime. Where can people see it now, Phil? Is it available?
It's coming out when spring training starts. So end of February, beginning of March, and it will be literally everywhere.
Amazon Prime, yeah. Netflix,
VOD,
all these various things.
Yeah.
Where's your movie going after the Siskel?
Well, we just had a screening in Washington, D.C. at the George Washington University. We're going to be showing it at Notre Dame this spring. We're talking to the University of Michigan, their theater, but we're also talking to distributors.
I'll bet you distributors would sort of be a little shy of this film. I mean, not that it's controversial. You make your point clearly.
Well, it's a shock to some people because it's a story that's not widely known, that 1.4 million union members basically lost their right to free speech and due process.
Well, what happened was when Bobby Kennedy was grilling Jimmy Hoffa in the Senate committee, Senate kind of the government came in and wanted to clean up the Teamsters mm-hmm. because there was some mobster mm-hmm. influence being peddled there. But to everybody who is in the know, they took care of that, the government, in about 3 years, but decided to stay on with this internal review board, a bunch of lawyers, three lawyers, because they could bill $1,000 an hour.
Yeah.
And make all sorts of pronouncements and deals that did nothing but weaken the unions and fill their pockets.
It was not a hands-off deal by any means. They profited by staying on board.
For 30 more years.
30 years. Justice Department officials acknowledged that the criminal elements were removed within the first 3 years.
Yeah.
And yet they stayed on getting anywhere from $4 to $6 to $10 million a year. And when the bad guys were gone, they went after some of the best officials who were complaining about the continued government control of the union.
Well, Jimmy Hoffa Jr., who you can't play, you, Phil, could play Billy Hogan, don't you think? Very charismatic guy who was respected widely. He was the son of a Teamster. His kids were Teamsters, but also a very charismatic guy.
Yeah.
He was not allowed to speak. This sounds like something out of some
it's
bizarre...
It's hard to believe.
He couldn't talk to his best friend. He couldn't talk to his sons.
When they trumped up charges against him, and barred him for life, because of a misreading of a situation in Las Vegas, where he was
trying to be helpful.
Yeah. And then they turned it into. Some kind of
scandal.
You had these temporary trade show workers who got a 40% increase as a result of this deal, and yet they were saying that he was undermining the contract. It was really ridiculous.
Well, when you hear it in the movie, when it plays out in the movie, it is real. All he was trying to do is help his. You have people like Billy Maravitz, Christy Hefner, all manner of former union officials saying that Billy Hogan was the best thing that ever happened to the Teamsters.
And
he couldn't talk to his best friend of 50 years.
It was amazing because once you're barred, anybody who's still in the union can lose their jobs, their careers.
For talking.
Simply for talking to Bill. And then Bill was told that actually they charged him with, simply talking to these friends of his, and he faced a six-month contempt of court jail sentence. He eventually, after years of fighting, he settled the case without admitting any wrongdoing, but it almost ruined him financially.
Well, as one of the people in your film says, he says, Bob Riley, Hogan's old friend, it says, hard to believe this could happen in America. It's impossible for him to believe that. In High and Outside, that is also a kind of sad, in its way, story of a father and son relationship. The father was a famous ball player. The son is a guy clinging desperately to life in the minor leagues and desperately to the hope of a big league career.
Right.
You have to say?
Yeah, I don't.
You're going to be really good on Letterman, man.
I'm concerned Letterman's about my tab at the Billy Goat. That's all I can think about, Rick. No, I it's a really dark
don't
movie.
Worry about that.
It's a really, really dark movie, and and I'm really excited for it to sort of come out for everyone to be able to see how, guys who love baseball.
It's about passion.
Yeah, it's a good, and it's a father-son story. And it's, and more than that, it's Jeff Lewis's last film.
What was it like? I mean, you two seem inordinate, though there are some, sort of very contentious scenes between the two of you in there. But it seems that there is something else. There's an energy that you share on screen that is palpable.
Yeah, well, Jeff and I off screen were extremely good friends for a long time. When he died, it was very hard for me.
I'll bet.
We hung out a lot. Even though he was, way older than me, but we just connected. And it was like I was a part of the Lewis family, like Juliet was like a sister or whatever, so it was like when I was doing the movie, Jeff had a lot of trust for me and I had a lot of trust with him on screen. And a lot of the stuff I did was difficult to do.
Sure.
Because, you don't always know how far to push something when you're working with another actor. But he gave me, his thing he always said was, let her rip. He would say that.
Wow.
It was like it was his term. So there's one really hard scene in there where I kind of slap him around a little bit.
Yeah.
And I really did. And I felt really bad about it the next day. He did say, in all the years, in all the movies...
No one has dared slap me like that. You'll never work in this business again.
I felt very bad. I felt really bad. And I called him the next day just to check in on him and say, are you okay? And he said, I've done a lot of movies with a lot of actors. And he said, I've never, ever once before been concerned for my personal safety other than that night, last night. And I was like, oh, God.
This guy's made movies with Clint. He made a lot of movies with Eastwood. He was a sort of go-to guy for Eastwood.
But he said, look, I was very happy with what we did. I was proud of what we did. So it was all worth it, I suppose. It's up on the screen. And he gave me a lot of room to really play, and it was hard. And it was hard for Jeff too, because he had a stroke.
Yeah,
and so he had a hard time kind of remembering his lines sometimes. So we would be doing takes. I mean, the director knew this, and this was sort of built into the shooting. So we would roll 25-minute takes sometimes, because we would have to. And he didn't want to cut, and we had to keep everything up.
Wow.
You know. But look, testament to him, he stuck in it. You know.
It's a great movie too, and he is really. You and George are going to exchange films, aren't you?
Yeah.
And it's gotten tremendous reviews, not just for me.
Right.
Who's an easy mark for you these days.
You know, it was interesting. We opened the film when we did the festival circuit. It opened in London.
Oh,
and it was amazing, of all places, to open a baseball movie
in
London.
Right.
But they loved it. And what's weirder was we sort of thought that it was really going to be like, because it's all men in the movie, but it's like our best audience is women. It's why it's just it's been the antithesis of everything.
Well, it's a human story. I mean, it's a father and son story when you get right down to it, and passion and hope and dashed dreams kind of thing. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We got to take a break, and we'll carry on with George Bogdanich talking about. Is there a website for the movie? No.
Yes, betrayalfilm.org.
Oh, thank God. Yeah, most people. Betrayalfilm.org. And there isn't a high. Is there a high and out size?
There is.
There is.
Yeah, and I don't know what the website is.
Good research there, my friend. Good research.
Yes, exactly.
Good research there.
Takes
my
one
friend.
To know one, right?
Yeah, we're genius. Yeah, we're the non research guys. We're the spontaneous.
We don't
We're the method. We're the method radio guys. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. We have a few more minutes with George Bogdanich and his new best friend, Phil Donlan.
Yes.
Two filmmakers, passionate, talented filmmakers. Phil, there is a website for High and Outside.
highandoutside.com.
Fabulous.
Yes.
And George, yours was again, Betrayal.
Betrayalfilm.org.
Okay. Betrayalfilm.org. You both have one of the nice things that your film does, George, without beating it to death, it gives you a relatively quick history of the Teamsters, the most powerful. That at one point, 1 in 10 union members in this country are members of the Teamsters, and you have someone in the movie saying, "We're the biggest union on the planet, except for the Soviet Union." It was immensely powerful.
It was. There were 2.2 million people at their apex. And it's down to a little bit less than 1.4 million today.
Wow. Mostly part of this government malfeasance.
That has harmed the union. It has discouraged anybody from really stepping out and showing the kind of leadership that... You know, created the union.
Hoffa Jr. still run the union?
Hoffa Jr., if it wasn't for Canada, he would have lost the last election.
Canada voted for him, or what?
Canada had a slight majority, and that was enough to get him across.
Boy, he comes off in this movie badly. He is. I think this movie becomes so much more timely in a way, and anything that makes more people want to see Betrayal is good, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. That the Irishman, here you have, as you get your great imitation of Al Pacino, Phil Donlan. What did you think of that movie? I mean, it's about the, part of it is the life and death of Jimmy Hoffa and the supposed killer.
Well, now you would be able to talk more about the actual what's real and what's not. But from a film standpoint, an interesting little anecdote, because I'm friends with Danny DeVito. I'm not name dropping, other than this is a convenient time to tell this. Pacino ran up to him in the airport, because I talked to him a couple of weeks ago. I guess Pacino ran up to him in the airport and he goes, "Danny, I'm sorry, I had to play it," because he made Hoffa. And Danny's like, I don't care. It's not like I own... In perpetuity, Hoffa. But, I think that sums up the movie. I thought it was, it's not a bad movie, but it's forgettable. I thought it was very boring. I thought De Niro walked through the movie. Pacino yelled and screamed the whole time. I suppose Pesci's okay. The CGI that they did, or the de-aging they did on their faces, was pointless because the actors still moved like they were 80 years old. I mean, De Niro threw, I thought he was going to throw his hip out in a scene when he's trying to kick a guy's face on the curb.
Well, he goes to kick, to beat up like the owner of a grocery store who did something to his daughter. And it's a scene reminiscent of the scene in Goodfellas where he and Pesci and the other guy beat to death the kid and the guy in the bar, the mobster in the bar.
Yeah.
And he does move like he is 70-something years old.
I looked at this movie and I thought, why make it? Why are we doing this? Why? I would rather watch Casino or Goodfellas, which I think are far superior. Those are his masterpieces.
George, anyway, you who know about as much about Hoff as anybody walking into The Irishman to see it, what do you think of it?
There were a number of problems with The Irishman, and including the central one that Frank Sheeran, who is shown in the movie being the assassin of Jimmy Hoffa, is likely not the assassin of Jimmy Hoffa. That comes from Jack Goldsmith, who's written a book in Hoffa's shadow, and it's been really well
debunked.
Sheeran was a real person. He was a gangster. He did work for Russell Bufalino, but he bragged about hits that have been established by other people, and it's more likely a henchman of Tony Provenzano that
who was the other union rival.
He was a rival from New Jersey and was a thoroughly corrupt guy, local 560. So I love Scorsese and I love De Niro, but I think this was, based on a story that doesn't hold water.
I think it's the death knell of mob movies. I think Scorsese has killed the goose. I don't think you're going to see much of anything.
Well, I don't
like
think
this.
Those guys are coming together and make Goodfellas 2 or something.
You know what's interesting? I read an interview that Pesci gave, and he was very open in the interview. He got the script, and I guess he said to Scorsese, he goes, "We already made this. Why are we doing this again?" He goes, "Oh, no, we're doing something."
I think probably his admiration for Scorsese is what he hadn't been in a movie in 20 years, Pesci, and he might win an Academy Award for this. One of the most fascinating characters, when you even mention the word mobster, was a fellow named Ron Carey. This guy, straight-looking guy. Tell people
Ron Carey was supposed to be the reformer. And there were a lot of people that were hoping that he was going to be just that, there were a lot of, people that invested a lot of hope in Ron Carey, and then it turned out, his local in Queens had been involved with the Lucchese crime family.
Yeah,
they had their pension fund had been used, to do juice loans. And Rudy Giuliani, in fact, had prosecuted that particular case, but he gave a pass to Ron Carey, and then lo and behold, after he used the RICO statute to take over the Teamsters Union, the independent review board that they set up was promoting Ron Carey as a reformer.
Yeah,
and
he was anything but.
Yeah, this is a guy that supposedly had a $40,000 a year job at his local, and he had beachfront property in Key West.
That's a great part of this thing.
His family inherited $2 million worth of UPS stock, which he did not disclose, and the UPS was the largest employer of Teamsters at the time. He built a widow out of her, pension. So
He's another, and your film, there are a couple of heroic people in it, Hogan among them. and Christy Hefner and Billy Maravitz and some others, some former union guys. Was it hard to get any of those guys to talk?
Well, eventually, if they, the people you're interviewing think you know what, understand the deal, you know, and that you're not coming to them with some naive misunderstanding,
right,
then they'll start to talk to you.
Well, it's interesting that Jimmy Hoffa Jr. did not deign to sit in front of your cameras, did he?
No, he didn't.
How did you try?
Well, we went through his PR person and also Giuliani, interestingly enough. He originally agreed to be interviewed.
He did.
And, you know, we flew to New York. We had the film crew in the hotel and so on. We got a call and they said, well, we can't do it. And they wouldn't set another date. So I think he understood that we knew what actually went down when Giuliani took over or used the RICO statute to take over the Teamsters Union, which was a three-decade-long assault on civil liberties.
Sure. How are the Teamsters these days? And what kind of shape? I know you're not an expert. You're as expert as anybody I know.
Well, we'll see, because it's supposed to end in 2020.
2020, right.
And I don't, you know, until Hoffa is defeated, I don't see a dynamic union coming back. There are, you know, there are talented leaders out there, but I
but
think
he's been entrenched. He's been entrenched for so long.
He has since the late 90s.
I think that's part of the reason, too. When you think Teamsters, that's part of what gave Teamsters and indeed unions a bad reputation for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, I find interesting. I mean, when you're backing it up, you're talking about the Kennedys and the,
sure,
you know, and it's like, well, you know, who swung the vote? Who swung the vote for JFK here? You
right.
Know, it was
right.
Criminals, you know, who did that. Who, you know, and then you look at, you know, Vegas, like Pileggi, when I was working with Pileggi on the, with Lords.
Yeah.
You know, and he was, you know, because he wrote Casino, and he ran me through the entire history of the Teamsters and what.
And organized crime.
Vegas, and they, and the pension fund, and then when they knocked down Vegas, you know, these junk bonds, you know, which now have built these places where it's like Disneyland, but you know, it's like, what's a junk bond?
There are a lot of stories out there. That's what you guys
one
find.
One thing, though, that I would like people to understand, you know, when you see the Irishman and so on, and you know, the gangsterism that was portrayed in all of that, is that since basically around 1992, the criminal elements have been gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of decent Teamsters.
Hard-working
Teamsters out there organizing. And
My girlfriend who works for the Chicago Teachers Union is a Teamster.
Okay.
She may fly, Phil's met her, yeah, and she may fly in the face of the image of the Teamster,
right,
but she is nevertheless a Teamster. And I think there's maybe a resurrection of that.
Well, they're in all kinds of professional areas and... it's a very diverse union.
Yeah. You hopeful for the labor movement in general? I mean, this is way off base.
I think recently you've seen signs of, labor asserting itself again.
Yeah. I mean, here GM, with the Chicago Teachers Union.
Chicago Teachers Union. My gosh, in Western Virginia.
Yep.
You know, teachers in Oklahoma. You know, enough is enough.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you, Phil Donlan, for coming here. What's the website of that movie again?
High and Outside. Spell out the and. Yeah.
Dot something.
Dot TV or it's got a MySpace page. I
yeah,
think
you'll,
I
you'll find it.
Yeah,
you'll find exactly. It. And George, yours again is
BetrayalFilm.org.
George's movie, Betrayal, When the Government Took Over the Teamsters Union, and that is not mincing words, will be at the Cisco Center this coming Saturday and on January 9th. You can go to CiscoFilmCenter.org. And Phil Donlan's film, High and Outside, A Baseball Noir, will be available on all sorts of, what do they call them, platforms?
Yeah, all streaming services. You know, it'll be in Walmart and Target and all of that. So, yeah, right around spring training time. Keep an eye out.
Happy New Year, fellas. And all of the guests that are back there. Who's back there with you, Phil? Who's
we got the young. We got the young Albin Sikora. And the rest is my marketing team.
We call it an entourage. Yeah, exactly. We call it an entourage. Yeah. Phil, it's been great to see you over the holidays. Yes. George, keep me posted when that film's going to be. It's at the Cisco Center this Saturday and on January 9th. And it's going to be screening in South Bend sometime in the near future. It's a hell of a movie. And Phil, you watch it and then tell me what you think.
Absolutely. I really look forward to seeing it. It looks fantastic.
Ro Coleman, you're the world's greatest producer. Ernie Skatton, you are the world's greatest engineer and a Sox fan.
Yes. Go Sox.
You people back there are the greatest audience the show has ever had. They're raising their thumbs. Siskel and Ebert. Yeah. Siskel and Ebert at the movies.